I'm Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, one reason Americans don't see eye to eye on much of anything anymore, students in different states are taught different versions of history. We'll spend this hour with Dana Goldstein of the New York Times, who examines social studies textbooks with the same titles issued by the same authors in different formats in California and Texas, states whose huge populations allow them to dictate what's available to schools in many other states. We'll talk about what California emphasizes but Texas ignores and vice versa, and how those differences could shape students' political leanings. Our conversation starts after a short break. Social studies textbook in California, and you'll learn about the effects of post-war redlining of American suburbs designed to keep Black families from moving in. Flip through a textbook by the exact same authors published for Texas students, redlining is never mentioned. It's as if it never happened. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Social studies and history textbooks sold to schools are customized to meet the demands of regulators in California and Texas, but the same books can be sold to districts in other states as well. And as my guest discovered, some of the stories students learn are so strikingly different, it's as if they're talking about two different countries. Dana Goldstein covers education policy as a national correspondent for the New York Times, which published her article, Two States, Eight Textbooks, Two American Stories, earlier this month. Dana, welcome to Think.
Thanks so much, Chris. I'm pleased to be here.
Why did you look at textbooks produced for Texas and California specifically?
I wanted to look at those two states because they're so large and because they do adopt their textbooks at the state level and give some directions to districts on which books they think are the best for local schools to use. They have a lot of influence. If you, as a publishing company, create a textbook and it is not adopted at the state level in Texas and California, you may not have a successful product on the marketplace because these are such large, large purchasers of books. So I think one of the best ways to see how politics was influencing the writing of history and the teaching of history was to really look at these two states, whose politics are, of course, so different with the sort of progressive or left-wing of the Democratic Party in power in California and with social conservatives wielding so much influence in Texas.
So for people who don't live in Texas or California and are listening, it's possible they have students who have received one version or another of textbooks made these ways.
It's possible, but even if your own state's name is on your book, inside the text will be specific sentences and passages that may have first been drafted or created with one or both of these two states in mind. So the content that we revealed here with our analysis is very much in other books across the country.
So what sort of material does social studies cover? It's not the same as history. It's not quite the same as civics. What is it?
Well, social studies can be world history, American history, it can be economics, it could be geography. This investigation specifically looked at what is typically covered in 8th and 11th grade, which is the United States history sequence. Most 8th graders are doing through the sort of Western colonization of North America through the Civil War or Reconstruction. And then most 11th graders are doing about the late 19th century to the present day.
So what was your process for analyzing these textbooks?
Well, the first step was to actually get the textbooks on my desk. We eventually got 43 textbooks from major publishers, but it was quite a process. The publishers did not all want to quickly send me the books. I really had to make a strong argument to them that these are purchased with taxpayer dollars and ought to be something a journalist and the public ultimately can look at. Once I got the 43 books, some of them were from first states other than California and Texas, I started flipping through them. I know that because state policymakers are able to ask publishers for edits and revisions, I knew politics was going to be in these books. I did not know what issues or events in American history were going to rise to the top of this analysis until I actually sat down and read almost 5,000 pages of American history here.
Both books in both states obviously cover the Bill of Rights. So what does the California version note that the Texas version leaves out?
This was one of the most stunning examples and the one that actually opens up our article, which you can see at newyorktimes.com. But McGraw-Hill, which is one of the biggest publishers, their book is one of the most widely used. In both the California and Texas edition for eighth graders, they have an annotated Bill of Rights with the 10 amendments, and there's a little bubble next to the amendments explaining each one. Now in California, next to the Second Amendment, you learn that the courts have sometimes made rulings that allow for some gun regulations. That bubble does not exist in the Texas book. The Texas book does not say anything at all about the Second Amendment. So you almost sort of give to the child that's looking at this in Texas an originalist reading of that Second Amendment, which is the one conservatives appreciate more because you're not updating it with any sort of sense of what has happened since it was written in the 18th century.
So it's not that they're putting wrong information in there, but it's sort of omitting context?
Yes, it's an omission.
Students in both states get a lesson about the Harlem Renaissance. So how are they different, California and Texas?
Yes, this was something we saw in multiple publishers' books. The Texas books will sometimes include additional language that speaks critically or negatively, not just about the Harlem Renaissance, but also about other non-white cultural movements, such as the Chicano mural movement, which was an artistic movement of the 1960s and 70s. And digging back through the minutes of the Texas Board of Education to find the source of this, in 2010, 2011, the Texas Board of Education debated which cultural movements students should learn about. Should students learn about hip hop, about country music, about rock and roll, about the Beat Generation? And some conservatives on the board did not want students to learn about majority non-white cultural movements. The sort of compromise that the liberals and conservatives on the Texas board eventually came to was that it was okay for students to encounter, say, the Harlem Renaissance, but they ought to hear, quote, both the positives and negatives of it. So that's the source of Texas students reading a sentence, which is really quite stunning in one publisher's book, that critics, quote, question the quality of literature produced by figures like Langston Hughes and Zora Neale Hurston, who are, of course, members of the American canon. I think since then, Texas has struck this positive and negative requirement, but the books were published in 2016 before Texas made this change, and social studies books often hang around for 10 years or sometimes even more.
Yeah, what's really interesting about that is on the one hand, you could sort of take a straight reading of that and say, this is going to influence students to think more critically about works of art produced by non-white artists. I suppose a teacher could use that same material to say, the sort of people in power to criticize at the time were white people and they didn't appreciate it. But it doesn't sound like that's really, you have to really dig to get that out of the text.
Yes, I think that's right. I don't think there's anything wrong. And many educators I've spoken to for the piece and since the piece was published, you know, they do point out that many white critics did miss the genius of the Harlem Renaissance. But to sort of put forward the idea that questions are being raised or were being raised about the quality of literature produced during the Harlem Renaissance without contextualizing it in that way, you know, who were the critics that were given the opportunity to opine on this art? If they were part of the dominant racial group, maybe why? Why did they miss how brilliant this work was? I think without that context, you have to question whether it belongs there historically.
What did you learn about how social studies textbooks are written by their authors? Like, how do they collaborate? What criteria did they use to decide what's important before they actually submit their texts for publication?
Yeah, so what I learned is in many ways the authors are the least important people in this process. And let me explain a little bit more about that. When your child is given a book in school or when you as a student are handed a book in a high school, say, there's going to be a few names on the cover of the book or inside. Sometimes you have to dig around to find those names. And this is usually three or four or five academic historians who've sort of come together as a committee, and each one is going to take on some of the responsibility of writing the text. Now, what I found is that many of these texts were first drafted years or even decades ago. many of the authors on books used in classrooms today are dead. So as the states through the years go ahead and promulgate new regulations related to what should be taught in history classrooms and what the textbooks should say, those authors very often are just not involved with the process of revising these texts over the years. So when a state like California or Texas comes out with social studies standards that tell publishers what they want in the books, those go to the insides of the hallways of a company like McGraw-Hill or Pearson or Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. And staff who work at those companies or consultants hired by those companies then revise the text, often with no input from the authors whose names are on the book.
Wow. So the editing process when state education authorities weigh in on what needs to be added or deleted, does that go back to them to approve after the changes have been made?
That's right. So the state will first put out a standards document, which is for teachers, but also for textbook publishers. And the textbook publisher will start revising and putting new language and taking things out of the books to meet those standards. And once that process is done, it goes back to state policymakers and to these appointed boards of people in both California and Texas who review drafts of textbooks and give feedback to publishers, very detailed feedback, you know, down to specific phrases, specific sentences that they don't like. And it is only after the publisher, you know, fulfills those requests or responds to those requests from these boards of appointed textbook reviewers that the state will then adopt the book and put it on the official list of recommended books.
So the original authors of the books, did they get any input into the kinds of changes made to suit authorities at the state level? Like, in other words, can they say, you know what, if you want to make this change, that's fine, but take my name off?
I don't think they can say that, and I think most of them have signed a contract at the front end agreeing that it is ultimately the publisher who decides what's in these books. Now, through my reporting process, I did speak to some textbook authors who request that the publisher send to them all revised material so that they can review it and they can give feedback. But that is unusual. Those authors who choose to stay that involved in the process, that's not the norm.
So what do we know about how teachers feel about these textbooks purchased for them to use? Because typically, right, it's at the school or even the district level that textbooks are chosen. Teachers don't necessarily get to pick which book they want.
Right. So I interviewed many teachers for the project, and I'd say the overwhelming consensus is that they do know that the content of the book is incomplete. They know that it's a politicized process that has landed this book on their doorstep. And the vast majority of sort of veteran teachers have tried to move their teaching away from relying too heavily on the textbook. You know, I spoke to Carrie Green, who's a teacher in the suburbs of Dallas, and she really wants to teach redlining. So even though the Texas state standards don't mention redlining or housing discrimination against African Americans, she goes out of her way to bring that into her classroom, find her own resources online. And, you know, while she's doing that, she's kind of working on her own. She doesn't necessarily have a lot of guidance either from the state standards or from the textbook itself on how to do that. You know, that's different than in California, where the documents you get from the state and the textbook that goes along with it are going to be very clear in sort of telling you as a teacher, this is how we think you should go ahead and teach housing discrimination and redlining. This is when in the curriculum. These are the years. You know, we should talk about this in the 1950s with the rise of suburbanization and post-war prosperity and have it as a counterpoint to that sort of more optimistic story. So, you know, less experienced teachers or teachers who are less motivated to go out and do their own research, they're the ones who are looking probably most closely at the textbook.
Just to digress for a moment, are these textbooks well written? Are they written in a way that is compelling for 8th and 11th graders?
You know, it's an interesting reading process for me. I'm 35, so I'm about 20 years removed from reading these books as a student myself. I mean, I think the books have a written by committee feel, and that's because they were written by committee. So they don't necessarily have an authorial voice or a tone that's really engaging. You know, the first drafts of these books are written by sort of groups of historians, and then they're revised and edited by so many different writers that, you know, what results from that is something that can be pretty boring to read. I will say there is one change that especially the California books have embraced, which is positive, which is bringing more primary sources and historical voices into the books. So when you get a chance to, you know, read an excerpt of a Frederick Douglass speech, that really brings it alive.
My guest is Dana Goldstein, national correspondent for The New York Times. She covers education policy. Her recent article is Two States, Eight Textbooks, Two American Stories. We'll be right back. Listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Dana Goldstein. She covers education policy as a national correspondent for the New York Times. A couple of weeks ago, the paper published her article, Two States, Eight Textbooks, Two American Stories. It's an investigation of the way that social studies material differs by textbooks published by the same authors and the same publishers in the states of California and Texas, which may have influence on the content published for social studies students in other states as well. All right, Dana, explain again about how in each state textbook drafts are reviewed. Whose job is it to look at social studies textbooks and say, this needs to go, we need to add this, and we want the language changed here?
Yeah, that's a great question. So in Texas, your Board of Education, which is, as you know, popularly elected by the citizens of Texas, will appoint textbook review panel members. And in Texas, those members could be parents, they could be teachers, they could be community members. In one case I found with a panel that was reviewing a set of American history textbook, there was a prominent socially conservative minister who later became a Republican politician who was on one of those panels. So it's a disparate group of people who are coming at the task with, I think, different frameworks and objectives. In California, the State Board of Education also appoints textbook reviewers. But there, it's a process that's completely dominated either by teachers of social studies or by college professors of education or history. So the only type of person pretty much that was reviewing American history textbooks in California was an educator. So it's a more professionalized process, you might say, in California. On the downside, there isn't as much of an opportunity, perhaps, for ordinary members of the public who are interested in the curriculum to participate in California.
Do those curriculum boards typically solicit opinions and assessments from teachers themselves?
They can get feedback from the public, from teachers, from parents, from students, and then pass that on to publishers. And especially in Texas, I saw some evidence of that going on. But it's really interesting because the Republican Party dominates the Board of Education in Texas, the folks on these panels were much more likely to have a conservative ideology. So the types of changes that I saw the review panels requesting in Texas were to make clear how many clergymen signed the founding documents of the United States. Can we clarify that the founding fathers were influenced by the Protestant Great Awakening? Those are two specific examples. Now, in California, what the review panels, which were totally dominated by people with a more liberal ideology, what they were asking for was totally different. You know, when Levi Strauss, the inventor of blue jeans, is brought up, the review panel in California is saying, well, can we please clarify that he's Jewish and the descendant of immigrants? They're always trying to add diversity and a focus on minority groups in California. California also requested that the word massacre not be used when talking about Native American attacks on white settlers during westward expansion of the United States. So they're coming from a very, very different place in the two states.
So we assume that students are learning from these books, that they take a perspective away. On the other hand, you know, a lot of people might say we should be so lucky that students retain so much from 8th and 11th grade social studies that it shapes their politics for life. Is there anyone attempting to understand how much of an impact this has on the way students think about the world?
So there's not good research on exactly how students interact across the country with textbooks. I think it's well known in the social studies profession that the sort of best practices are to move away from strict reliance on the textbook. But what I've been saying and what I've been hearing from educators is these curriculum materials, the textbook, the state standards, which are politicized, they are most influential on the teacher. And the teacher is the most important influence on the student. So if I'm a teacher and I'm wondering, you know, which primary sources on the founding fathers do I want to go out and assign to my students, I may take a look at that textbook and the bolded names in that book. And if there are fewer women or fewer African American names bolded in my book, I may not go out and obtain as many diverse primary sources. So those are some of the ways that the textbook and the state standards are influencing our kids.
How do the two states cover white resistance to Black progress in America?
Yes, this was one of the big themes of our investigation. So the redlining example is an important one. You know, Texas doesn't include the concept of housing discrimination. It also doesn't include the concept of white flight, the idea that when white people left urban neighborhoods in the 1950s, some of them were doing so to avoid diversity. That is much clearer in the California textbooks and the California standards. When it comes time to cover Reconstruction or the years after the Civil War, the Texas book will state that Southerners opposed Reconstruction not only because of hostility toward Black progress, but also because they didn't want to pay higher taxes. The California book does not include that second point about taxes. It does include more primary sources from Black thinkers of the 19th century reflecting on the triumphs and failures of Reconstruction. So these are some of the big changes, differences between the states that we noted.
Major differences as well in explanations as to why Southern whites resisted Reconstruction after the Civil War.
Right. Yes, that's the one I just mentioned. And then the other one that I think is important to note is lynchings. So, for example, both books from both states will say that breaches of racial etiquette led to the lynchings of African Americans. So, you know, the stereotypical Black boy whistles at a white woman type of incident. But the California book will go further. It will mention, you know, a specific set of lynchings to make the point that white violence was often targeting Black businesses, Black economic power, or it would spring up after Black voters had flipped an election. So it was a response to Black politics and political empowerment. So a bit of a richer discussion in some of these California books on what motivated that white resistance.
How much longer are California social studies textbooks than Texas ones?
They are longer. The emphasis on diversity, for example, LGBTQ history, that is a big theme in the California books. It's almost completely absent in the Texas books. There's more in some of the California books on Asian American immigrant groups. The emphasis on the primary source historical voices, like Frederick Douglass is one who comes to mind. All of that takes up more space. So in some cases, the California book will be, you know, 100 or 200 pages longer.
Wow. So California has something called the Fair Education Act. What is that exactly?
This is a law that was signed by the former governor, Jerry Brown, which requires students to learn about the contributions of LGBTQ and disabled Americans. So when this law passed, the textbook publishers really sprang into action. They created thousands of words of new text for these books, talking about, you know, homosexual family structures under slavery and Reconstruction, talking about how during the Red Scare attacks on socialists and communists, there was also a Lavender Scare attacking gay people, talking about the Kinsey Report in the 1950s, talking about, you know, non-binary gender identities in Native American tribes. The list really goes on and on. So there's quite a through line in these California books of LGBTQ history.
People may recall that, like, social studies books often contain these little sidebar stories written by people whose life experiences offer context. I think you mentioned this a little bit before. This was so interesting to me. So in Texas, high school juniors read something in the immigration section of their social studies textbook written by, a Border Patrol agent?
Yes, this was a really interesting example. In the same place in the California book, instead of featuring the Border Patrol agent, There's a fictional excerpt about a Dominican-American immigrant family that's really sort of asking students to empathize with the experience of being an immigrant.
It's really an interesting question because neither one of them is necessarily invalid or wrong or inappropriate to include, but it seems like people in both states would want to have both kinds of perspectives.
Yeah, I agree with you completely. There's quite a bit of nuance in the Border Patrol agent's statement, which goes on at some length and is present there in that McGraw-Hill, Texas book. You know, he talks about the fact that most immigrants are good people that are simply coming to the United States looking for work and opportunity. But then he also talks about drug trafficking. And, you know, he says he's concerned that an open border would lead to social upheaval. So that's one viewpoint. And, you know, looking at that alongside the fictional excerpt would probably be a really valuable exercise, but that's not the way the book is manufactured.
How much does community activism influence changes to these textbooks in either political direction?
I think it influences it enormously. The LGBTQ community was very active in California pushing for that FAIR Act law, which we just discussed a few minutes ago. Similarly, in Texas, as I'm sure your listeners are aware, there's been many decades now of, you know, agitation and activism on the right to sort of imbue more conservative and sometimes Christian values into the classroom and into the curriculum. So these are ongoing battles. They've existed for decades and centuries. I don't think it's ever possible to have one totally unifying narrative of American history. It's healthy to debate these things. I also think it's sort of important for the public to understand how this is playing out.
Debate is a really interesting thing here because I think for some people who sort of learned history however many years ago and feel like things that happened in the past are settled, it can be easy to overlook the fact that, you know, one person might call it revisionist history. Another person might say, well, we now understand better than we did a generation ago how this actually worked.
Yes, I agree with you. And history is always being revised. There are many points where these two states tell history in the same way in 2020, yet the history is different than it was when I was in high school in the late 1990s. So I'll give you an example of that. You know, both states tell the stories of boarding schools for Native American children, which were these schools where the federal government sort of forced Native children to go to these places to sort of assimilate them into white culture. They had to dress like Europeans and they had to speak English, and their religious traditions were tamped down. And this is a real trauma in Native American history that I did not learn about in high school. I didn't know about this until college. It was really interesting to me to see that both Texas and California are now teaching this to 11th graders or 8th graders.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Are they teaching sort of both perspectives on that? Some people see this as an effort to bring Native peoples out of poverty. Ultimately, many people see it as an effort to destroy their attachment to their culture and cause them to sort of not go back.
Yes, I think both states describe what the hopes of the white federal government were with these schools, to sort of assimilate Native Americans into a, you know, staid farming lifestyle that seemed like the right one to those people at that time. But I think ultimately the cruelty of these boarding schools is what comes through from both states' textbooks.
Do states that use the sort of Common Core education standards tend to use the same textbooks and materials?
That doesn't impact social studies. Mm-hmm. Common Core is only for reading and math. So although some of the priorities of the Common Core may be reflected in these books, like the influence on primary sources, which California does embrace more than Texas, which has rejected the Common Core, the sort of historical events, the people who are discussed, that would not be impacted by the Common Core.
I was fascinated by the ways that Texas and California students are taught about the Gilded Age.
Mm. Yes. So California's state documents in social studies see income and wealth inequality as a unifying theme through all of global history. So not just in the present time, but through always. And they talk about that right during that sort of triumphant moment of the Gilded Age for American capitalism, they point out that this is when these huge monopolies not only began to consolidate the American economy in ways that sometimes hurt workers, but they also began to destroy the environment in certain parts of the United States, sometimes without repercussions for them as corporations. Now, Texas tells a much more positive story about companies like Standard Oil or titans like Andrew Carnegie. Andrew Carnegie is mentioned again and again in Texas curriculum materials as someone who is kind of an American hero who epitomizes our meritocratic, up by one's bootstraps ideals. So it was very kind of different emphases there.
And environmental regulation, how do the two state textbooks tend to frame that?
Yeah, so in addition to the California book speaking about the environment earlier in history, so going back to the 19th century, the California books were updated more recently than the Texas books, and they include a lot more information about the threat of global warming to coastal cities, how the nation's economy could be hurt by global warming. Interestingly, in some of the Texas books, I found some Republican talking points, just, you know, attacks on President Obama's attempts to regulate the environment, the sort of thing you hear a lot, which is that it doesn't make much of a difference if the United States takes big action on the environment because Brazil or India or China may not take equally large action. So what does it really matter what we do in the United States? This type of thinking was more present in one publisher's Texas textbook.
Were you able to get your hands on drafts of these textbooks before either state submitted their request for changes?
No. I mean, in some cases, these books already reflect so many years, if not decades, of revisions in response to the state mandates that it's a sort of difficult chicken and egg process. None of these books are completely absent of political influence or political concern on the part of the publishers.
My guest is Dana Goldstein, national correspondent for The New York Times. She covers education policy. Her recent article is Two States, Eight Textbooks, Two American Stories. We'll be right back. Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is New York Times national correspondent Dana Goldstein. She covers education policy and recently published an article called Two States, Eight Textbooks, Two American Stories. Is there any evidence, Dana, that other subjects would vary this much? In other words, I can think of the English language and literature curriculum perhaps would be another area that people would take a very different view of depending on their political orientation.
Yes. I mean, the books, for example, the fiction that is selected for students to read in English class varies extremely drastically, not just from state to state, but district to district. And those are some of the comments I've been getting from folks who've been reading this article, and hopefully we'll be able to do some follow-up reporting there.
Has anybody talked about, or are there any kind of federal curriculum standards?
There are not federal curriculum standards in the United States. Each time in history that the federal government has attempted to insert itself, it has really not worked out. It has kicked up so much controversy and accusations of loss of local control, which is a really essential founding principle of our school system, that has never really gone anywhere.
What do we know about the leverage other smaller states have? Are folks in North Dakota sort of limited to selecting what one of the larger states has asked for? Or is it possible for them to tailor make textbooks to their local and state standards?
Yes. Yeah, so whether a state has the gravitas to ask for edits to these books really depends on whether the state has a textbook adoption process, because not every state does. For example, I live in New York, one of the biggest states in the country. We do not adopt social studies textbooks here at the state level. So therefore, our state does not participate in much of a process with these publishers the way California and Texas does. Now, individual districts within New York, like New York City, are large enough purchasers purchasers of textbooks to request changes. And in fact, some very small places like the state of New Mexico, I found specific paragraphs that were in some of these books because New Mexico had requested it. So I think some people have the impression that only Texas and California matter in the process. That's not true. There are other states or districts that do large purchases of books that are able to ask for revisions.
Do you think it would be functionally impossible to make sure that students in every state, in every school district, learn essentially the same facts?
Yeah, absolutely. It would be totally impossible. And I don't want people to come away from this investigation and think, well, what a shame, you know, politics is perverting history or it's infiltrating on history. My understanding of history is it's sort of inherently political, what stories we tell about the past. I think the reason why we wanted to do this and why we rolled this project out at the beginning of 2020, a presidential election year, is it's a real illustration of how deep our divides in this country go. It's not just that some people listen to NPR and some people prefer Fox News, or some people read the New York Times and others are on Breitbart. It's those divides are at one level. But at a different level, our students are being exposed to different stories from American history in their childhoods. So that's why we wanted to focus on this.
How much do textbooks change from one edition to the next, produced for the same state?
They can change quite a bit, and that is one of the things I noticed when doing the research for this project. You know, when California embraced the idea of telling LGBTQ history, there were whole new segments of books that appeared over the course of a decade from the previous edition to the current one. So they can change very quickly.
Did you get pushback at all from state boards of education about this reporting?
No, I have heard no complaints about the reporting. I think each state is proud of the way that it chooses to teach American history and sees this reporting as evidence of the work that they do.
What do you know about how these textbook review boards resolve disputes? Surely you can't get a number of people in the room who feel like they have a stake in all this and not have them disagree pretty seriously on some of these things.
I'm sure there were disagreements behind closed doors. These meetings take place in hotel rooms in Sacramento and Austin, and members of the public are not typically at these meetings. There are not videos I was able to review of these meetings. I was able to see the documentation, the written notes that came out of them. And there I was able to see what different people asked for changes from the publishers. But as to whether there were kind of fights to even come up with that document, I was not able to see that.
In terms of the differences between the 8th grade social studies curriculum and the one in 11th grade, is 11th grade just expanding on ideas that were introduced in 8th grade, or are there different emphases?
It's a different time frame. So the Civil War is usually the dividing line. You do everything up to and including the Civil War in 8th grade, and you tackle those years after Civil War in 11th grade.
I'm curious about whether former students have said to you, yes, I had this textbook or that textbook, and I've had these experiences.
Yes, we've heard from quite a few college students who were using these books just a few short years ago and have said kind of uniformly in their emails to me or their messages on Twitter, I took my first college level American history class and my mind was blown. I mean, many people feel that they come to college without having known the true story of American history, specifically on issues of race, I would say, is one of the big themes that emerged in the letters we've received from readers.
It always seems a challenge to start teaching history to children who have no background. Like, you get to a certain point in your life and you've heard of these things over and over, and you get you develop an interest. But there really is kind of a where to start question.
I think that's a good point. I mean, the way most states approach it is with kindergarten, you're learning about your own neighborhood. Where does my house fit on the street? Who are the people that work in my neighborhood, the firefighters, the police officers, the librarians? So the way the social studies profession approaches it is by starting at the child's level. And then as they get older, you kind of zoom out and zoom out until you can zoom as far out as the nation and its founding ideals. And you can zoom to the entire world eventually. But yes, teaching a subject as vast as American history is a huge challenge to teachers. They have to cover hundreds of years of material, a lot of very thematically complex ideas like racism. That's why these curriculum materials produced by professionals are very important, because a teacher, say, 23 years old, right out of school themselves, still learning how to manage the classroom, deal with student behavior, put lesson plans together. They do rely at first very heavily on these materials.
Are there a lot of differences from state to state in the illustrations used in these textbooks?
No, there were not that many differences in the graphs and illustrations, which was notable to me. You know, for example, you might see a similar graphic in the Texas and the California book on a number of immigrants coming to the United States from various other parts of the world, but the text on immigration might differ.
So you mentioned that these meetings of the textbook review boards tend to happen like in hotel rooms. Are they secret? Like, are they not open? If someone from the public wanted to go and listen in, would they be allowed to do so?
That's a good question. If you were to reach out to your state board of education and ask them, do you have any textbook review panel meetings coming up? They would, I think, be forced to allow you to attend. But I don't think they publicize very heavily in advance when these meetings will take place.
Do the authors of these books offer any opinions at all about which edition is better overall, more accurate or more impartial? Are they willing to weigh in on California versus Texas?
Yeah, so I spoke to a number of the named authors of these books through my reporting. Only one of them, Al Broussard from Texas A&M University, is quoted by name in my piece because he was the only one willing to go on the record with me. So I'll talk about Al for a minute. He's based in Texas. He's a scholar of African-American history. You know, he stands by both the Texas and California editions of the book, but he does make clear that there are what he called, you know, crimes of omission in the Texas books. You know, the lack of a focus on housing discrimination against African Americans is one example of that. But Al Broussard also emphasized to me how much these books have moved forward from the past. And I found that to be true as well. You know, it was not that long ago that books would raise the question of whether African Americans were, quote, prepared for freedom after the Civil War, or if folks were happier living enslaved than free. And those types of dated attitudes and sort of blatant racism are not in contemporary books.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Do you know anything about how the textbook companies select authors? Is there like a bidding process? Do people show that they have expertise in writing for younger audiences? And how important is it to the textbook companies to have diversity on their writing staff?
That's a good question. They don't go out and look for new authors very often because the majority of the process is a process of revision, as we've been discussing. So I think they're looking for sort of mainstream voices in the history profession, the folks that are writing these books or may have written these books decades ago and are now being just sort of named, even though they've been revised thoroughly away from the first drafts. They're, you know, typical, well-respected university historians.
It seems like you could do a social studies unit just on the ability to really paint the same events in a different light, depending on the perspective you take.
Yeah, 100%. And that is what we are hearing from teachers. We have heard from many high school teachers and college professors who are using our investigation with their students. And that is, you know, more exciting to me as a reporter than anything else, because I really just want students to know that whatever book or documentary or TV show or podcast they pick up about politics or history, to really be able to ask themselves the question, who created this document? What's their point of view? What ideological forces are at play here and what I'm absorbing? I mean, that's how we turn into a critical thinker and a good citizen.
Do Do teachers have a lot of leeway to sort of diverge from the officially state-approved curriculum they're given?
I think it totally depends on the school and the state. So in Texas, for example, American history teachers are really focused on that test that high school students, the state test in American history that they have to pass to graduate. So teachers in Texas say, you know, that test, which is very tied to the state standards, which is very tied to the textbook, that's what I look at. That's something that is really going to determine how much time I spend on a topic. How likely is the topic to be on the test at the end of the year? In some states and districts, teachers may be really encouraged to go find their own curriculum materials, or they may have a mentor who's helping them find great primary sources. Other places may offer a lot less freedom in that way.
Do you know if those tests themselves reflect political biases? I mean, if we've decided the right answer is that Southern whites opposed Reconstruction because it was too expensive rather than because they really wanted to boost white supremacy, that becomes not like a question of perspective, but a question of right and wrong, theoretically.
Sure. I mean, the state standards, which again are the documents that the publishing companies are using to write these textbooks, they also determine the questions on the tests. And in some cases, the same publishing companies are creating the tests. So in the same way that political ideology shapes the textbook content, we could also expect it to shape the standardized test questions, although I have not done a review of the test questions in the same way.
Do you have any thoughts for parents listening to this in either California or Texas or any of the states that might receive books that are somehow similarly shaped by state boards who worry that their kids are somehow getting a biased view of social studies or history or just want them to think critically?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really important to say there are many progressive parents in Texas and many conservative parents in California. I think one thing you can do is take a look at your children's textbooks. Some parents have reached out to me to say, I looked at my child's book. I never thought to do that before. You know, maybe talk with your child about what is in the book that wasn't there when you were a student. Did you learn anything from this book? That could be a really interesting jumping off point. If it wasn't there when I was a kid, why do you think it's there now? How has our understanding of the past changed since I was in high school? You know, if you see something that seems to you like it's coming from a particular perspective, you could say, do you think there might be another way to shade this? Or I've read something different. Here's what I've read about this. So these are great conversations to have with your teenager.
Dana Goldstein covers education policy as a national correspondent for The New York Times, which published her article, Two States, Eight Textbooks, Two American Stories, earlier this month. Dana, thank you so much for making time to speak with us.
Thank you, Chris. My pleasure.
You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Our handle is at KERA Think. Subscribe to our podcast and learn about upcoming shows at our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.